Hello and welcome to another episode of Shattered Lives, Reach Ireland's crime podcast for the Irish Daily Mirror and Irish Daily Star. I'm crime and defence editor Michael O'Toole and I'm joined as ever by our crime correspondent Paul Healy. Hello Paul.
Hello Mick.
So this is another week in crime, and as ever it's been a very busy week in Irish crime. I've been busy. Paul, you were in court today for a case by the Criminal Assets Bureau.
I was, yeah. It was a fascinating case, the case against David Waldron. So David Waldron, he is a name that might be familiar to crime journalists and certainly anyone that follows the crime beat, but wouldn't be a name that would be in the papers every day. And like many criminals, they stay out of the limelight until they don't, and then everything comes out. And one way that comes out is in a case like this, a criminal assets case, because when it finally comes to a conclusion, and we'll talk about that in a second, this is a 4-year case. All the details come out because the Criminal Assets Bureau, they go after, it's in the title, they go after criminal assets, and they, in order to do that, they have to prove their case. So all of the detail, all the allegations that they make about a person comes out. And in this case, the allegations about David Waldron is that he is a major player in the criminal world in Dublin in the distribution and sale of drugs. And that is something that was said in the case by the chief officer of the Criminal Assets Bureau. And today, Judge Alex Owens affirmed that the evidence showed that David Waldron is a major player in the distribution and sale of drugs in Dublin.
And he is a convicted criminal.
He is a convicted criminal. He has convictions for possession of drugs, and he has served time in prison. He is somebody who would have been associated in the past with the likes of Eamon Dunn. His brother Christopher Gitt Waldron is also well known to Gardaí, and there was a separate criminal assets case in relation to him. Also had connections to the late Doughty Douglas, who was murdered by the Kinahan cartel. So a West Dublin criminal, and this case basically outlined exactly how much crime pays. So for the likes of David Waldron, he had 3 properties, one of which was in Dublin, one of which was in Leixlip in Kildare, and the other property in Wexford. And it's the Wexford property in particular that I suppose is going to create the headlines tomorrow. Because it's something of a spectacle of a house. It's not a house you or I would have the luxury of living in, Mick. It's pretty much what you describe as a mansion, a 1.6 million euro mansion in Wexford. And it is his family home, the home that he and his wife Charlene share. He now, after today, has to give that house up along with the 2 other properties I've mentioned. So coming to a total value of 3.3 million euro in assets that he has to give over to the Criminal Assets Bureau, who can now go and sell those. And basically the money goes back to the state.
That 3.3 million is a big hit. We know that the Criminal Assets Bureau, which was established after the murder of Veronica Guerin by the John Gilligan crime gang in June 1996, it has been hugely successful. But I would venture, I would suggest that, you know, you have things like Gilligan and, you know, and even the Byrne organised crime gang have been hammered by the Criminal Assets Bureau. But most Criminal Assets Bureau cases would not reach that threshold or that level of 3.3 million. So it's a big hit.
After the case, we spoke to Detective Chief Superintendent Michael Gubbins. And he explained, he basically outlined the importance of a case like this and why they took it. And he said, this is an individual who, over 20 years, amassed over 3.3 million euro, which they expended on 3 properties, which the Bureau have taken to the High Court and proven their case that these are the proceeds of crime. I think it establishes why the Bureau was established. And more importantly, it sends a message to the community of the value and the work that the Criminal Assets Bureau is doing in their area. And he says, it's not just the money we're taking off them, but the houses of these individuals. So it really is hitting them where it hurts.
So do you think it's a fair point, Paul, that really this seems to be, the Criminal Assets Bureau seems to be part of a twin track approach by the Guards Against Criminality or alleged criminality? If you can't get them in the criminal courts, they hit them in the pocket. Now, some people would say you're effectively taxing criminality, but I don't think there's any doubt that really it is a successful tactic, that if you can't get convictions against them, they say, right, we're going to persuade a judge that you've made money, that your money is proceeds of crime, and we're going to take that off you. Do you think it's been successful?
I think so, yeah, massively. And I mean, again, as I said, it's hitting them where it hurts. And you can see in this case in particular, you know, if you look at the judgment, the detailed judgment, you can see the forensic, just the level of the investigation by the Criminal Assets Bureau into the Waldrons and their bank accounts, their financial statements, and just how basically from his alleged legitimate means, how he couldn't possibly have had the finances to be able to afford the kind of lifestyle that they lived, you know, going abroad regularly, and owning these huge houses, three separate houses. So you're talking about he first purchased a house there in September 2001, Glenties Park, Finglas. He sold it then to buy a house in River Forest in Leixlip for $257,000. Then 2008, he bought the house in Ratto Road in Cabra for $330,000. And then he went on to ultimately buy this Darview House property and did it up. Several hundred thousand euro pumped into it, worth 1.69 million euro. When they dove into his bank accounts, obviously, with his car business and with another business that he set up, which was found to be effectively worthless, it goes to show the money didn't add up in terms of he was able to afford all of this, yet his actual legitimate income didn't match. So, yeah, hitting him where it hurts.
Was Mr. Waldron in court today?
No, he wasn't in court today, and okay. Neither was his wife. We pictured them today on the website, so you can see Charlene and you can see David Waldron pictured together, living their better lives before they were hit by the Criminal Assets Bureau. And you can see they've lived a life of luxury.
Let me ask you one thing, Paul. You mentioned that this was a four-year process. Mm. That is not unusual for the Criminal Assets Bureau. I mentioned Gilligan there. Like, I remember the guards went after the Gilligans really from 1997 when he was late 1996 when he was arrested over in England and then brought back. And that was the mother of all sagas that went to the Supreme Court. But eventually, it was at least 15 or 16 years, maybe more, before they got all the properties. So it does happen, but it does happen slowly, and I suppose it's a question of competing rights, and you can go to the Supreme Court, and you know, the judges in all the cases that have to defend the rights of the people who are under investigation or at the centre of the criminal assets investigation, shall we say. But it does happen slowly.
It does, and you know, I don't cover the criminal assets cases particularly often, but that is something today that frustrated me, not even just in covering this case, but in looking at some of the other cases that came up, and I won't mention them by name here, but you really got to see just how long a process this is, and just how, I'm not going to say people are abusing the legal system, but people are certainly utilizing the legal system. They're going as far as they can to delay the process. That is the people who are, you know, who the CAB are going against, using every single delay tactic in the book. I mean, there were at least 10 cases today that could not proceed because the other side had not submitted the correct affidavit on time or whatever. And as much as it annoyed the judge, most of the cases were put back, and they've been put back multiple times already. So you've got a hostile party on the other end that doesn't want to engage, and that delays the whole process. So this one took 4 years. Some of them take even longer. There's a case in there that's been going on since 2016. So, you know, it takes an awful long time.
And 2016 is significant just time-wise, just as an example, because that was when the Criminal Assets Bureau went after the Byrne Organised Crime Gang, and they seized all that property, and they seized the cars and everything. And I think that was probably finalised maybe 2020. Mm-hmm. So that's 4 years as well. So maybe that's the average length of time. Obviously, ones like Gilligan do take longer because there was a huge, big legal morass about that. But I think when it does come to assets and property, and maybe for the right reasons, that there have to be safeguards and everything, that it does take this length of time. But it's not like wham bam, thank you ma'am, and it happens. It is a drawn out process.
Yeah, and as I say, you've got the other side who are entitled to give a defence, and when you've got a hostile party like that, they're going to do everything to delay. But you also get to see their arrogance on full display. Like, for example, with David Waldron, I mean, he was trying to argue that he didn't have the money to pay legal fees, looking for legal aid, and there was a whole challenge in relation to that. Yet it came out that he had spent spend 5,000 euro on a child's christening party with two bands and a DJ, 100 guests. So he's spending that kind of money. And then on the other hand, he's saying, pay my legal fees.
Right. Speaking of long drawn out processes, it's 2 years ago last week that these famous or infamous sanctions were imposed against the Kinnans,
yes,
and the Kinnan cartel, and there were six or seven men named. Where are we on this? 2 years is quite a long time for a criminal investigation like this.
It is. And to be honest, there's no satisfactory answer to that question. Where are we on this? We can certainly speculate, and we're asking those questions, and that's exactly what I did on Sunday, because I was aware of that fact that we're 2 years on this month. So I asked, and I also thought it was newsworthy to ask our new Taoiseach, Simon Harris, because he hasn't commented on that since becoming Taoiseach. He was briefly actually Minister for Justice, so he is well briefed on this topic. And to my surprise, on a Sunday, actually, Simon Harris got back to me and gave us a quote in relation to it. Now, my question was nearly more one a political correspondent might nearly ask, because we've got about a year left in this government, and you've had Helen McEntee 11 months. Well, we might have less than that, but they have 11 more months. And Helen McEntee has been saying that she's working with the Garda Commissioner and trying to basically have the Kinahans brought to justice. Well, this government might not be in power in 11 months' time. And the question really I had was, you know, do they want to see the Kinahans brought to justice within the remaining term of government, within the remaining 11 months? So that was my question. Simon Harris didn't quite answer the question, but he said that they are fully supporting Garda Commissioner Harris in bringing the Kinahans to justice, that he remains fully briefed and he's fully determined to bring them to justice. So he's indicated and vowing that he will bring the Kinahan leadership to justice, but he wouldn't give me a timeline on that. But Helen McEntee, we asked her the same question, Minister for Justice, and she went further and actually said that she's doing everything in her power to ensure that that happens within this term of government. So she's got an 11-month timeline to make that happen. I suppose I was asking the question also in the context of what we discussed in the podcast the previous week, that the DPP, a file has gone to the DPP. They're soon to make a decision in relation to charging perhaps Daniel Kinahan with murder. So perhaps Helen McEntee is talking with some confidence that that'll happen, at least that the DPP might come back and direct a charge. It's another thing entirely then to take that 10 steps forward and to extradite the Kinahans and bring them back here. I don't know if that's going to happen within 11 months. But that's why we asked the question. Those are the answers that we got from the people in charge.
Is it a bit over-optimistic, perhaps 11 months
massively
at maximum? Mm. I think she may have been a wee bit over-optimistic there, I'll be totally honest with you. And you raise another important point there about a question political journalists asked. I didn't think they asked questions. I just thought everything was handed on a plate to them.
I know.
Martin Louise are fantabulous. Paul Carr. Anyway, so they want the Kinahans back here. There is another angle which you got.
Yeah.
You were speaking to the DEA, the Drugs Enforcement Administration in America. We know that the Americans have put these sanctions on. It wasn't Ireland, it was the Americans, and Dubai followed suit later on. Paul was giving out to me off air about the way I pronounced Dubai. Anyway, and the UAE authorities followed suit after that, but it was driven by the Americans. So your story was that the DEA said, we'll happily go after this fella and we'll bring him to America. Our plan, our aim is to bring him to America, or bring them to America to face charges.
Yeah.
So not necessarily Dublin.
Well, now, officially speaking, the DEA won't comment on active investigations. That is what I was told. But sources have told me that the investigation is progressing, which I hope it is. It's 2 years on since the DEA announced an investigation and a $15 million reward for information. They have received information I'm not privy to what that information is, but the investigation, I'm told, is progressing, and there is a degree of a belief, a better way to put it, that they will be the ones to act first. And certainly the Irish authorities would prefer that the Americans act first. The DEA bringing the Kinahan cartel out of Dubai and perhaps bringing them back to the US would make the matter of extradition a lot simpler, wouldn't it? And, you know, we've already talked in this podcast about if the Americans get involved, it's much more serious and they get their man, the DEA get their man. We've seen that in other cases that we'll discuss. So there is a degree of hope and confidence that the DEA will act first and then the Irish authorities, when we get a direction to charge, it'll make things a hell of a lot easier for them.
Paul, we'll have to face the reality. It's been 2 years. Now, that is a long time. Now, even, you know, we know that there is a file about Daniel Kinahan, and we know that they are working on a file in relation to all the Kinahans, and, you know, they've recommended, it's in relation to Daniel Kinahan, the guards have recommended he be charged over the murder of Jerry, Jerry Hutch's brother, Eddie, who was killed after 3 days after the Regency in February 2016. So that, look, that's a process. But would you not have expected movement within 2 years? Just to give you an example, at the GRA, AGSI conference here a couple of weeks ago, our former colleague, John Hahn, now in the Sun, we were doing a doorstep with the minister, and he asked about the Kinahans, right? Now, some hacks were going, are we asking about that again? I think he was totally right to ask that question, and I think he got the best angle from that in that she said, for me, it was, she jumped out and she said, I believe the UAE authorities in Dubai are fully on side with us. Now, that was a significant development. But from the other side, it's been 2 years, and I don't want to keep on labouring this. Would you not have expected something by this stage?
Yes, but there seems to be a change in the waters in the past couple of months. You know, I'm talking about Drew Harris going back and forth between Dubai, much more public comments being made, and then the file going to the DPP tells me something is afoot. And now from what I'm hearing on the American side of things, I don't know. I think by the end of this year, we should be talking a lot more confidently about things. I'm more hopeful. But I would have thought in the case of, say, Sean McGovern, you know, yes, a European arrest warrant was issued for McGovern this month, 2 years ago, and yet nothing has come of it. I would have thought by now we would have seen Sean McGovern returning to Irish soil.
And I think that's a very significant point. Just been speaking to some people who know much more about it than you and I do, and they would be of the belief that it is, if anything is to happen, it's much more likely that it will be Sean McGovern coming back here. He will be the first, might be the only one. Some people would have a view of a school of thought that, look, if necessary, the Kinahans would, I don't know if they use the word sacrifice, but the Kinahans might, you know, engineer it, that he's the one who is sent back, maybe to save themselves or whatever.
Interesting.
Because from what we've seen in John Mooney's great stuff in the Sunday Times the last couple of weeks, the Kinahans are extremely wealthy. We'll talk about their wealth in a minute, but they do seem to be very much rooted in Dubai society. We know that, for example, do you remember that one piece about Christy Kinahan when he gave his review about, you know, organising, it was an identity card, wasn't it, or a residency card, something like that. And he had to deal with the Dubai authorities there. And it just goes to show how well in he is. So there is a belief that they're so wealthy that they have soft backing from people of influence in Dubai.
Yeah, and, you know, similar to something we were saying on the previous podcast, you know, they have incredible wealth and clearly, you know, a very luxurious lifestyle over there in Dubai. We're not privy to what is really going on in their lives and the associates that they have made over there. It's quite likely that they have more protection than we're aware of. I mean, they haven't left Dubai. What's the reason for that? Are they quietly confident that they will be fine there? They've built up enough connections there. They're safe there. They have wealth. Look, I'm not trying to knock our authorities. As Helen McEntee says, they're doing everything possible. I
think that's fair. That is a fair point.
I even read into that comment of, like, it wasn't necessarily a political comment. I mean, I do actually believe that they are doing everything possible, but they are restrained. That's the other side of that sentence that she can't say out loud. I'm doing everything possible, but these are the barriers in the way. And those barriers, I don't think alone our Irish authorities are going to be able to break through. That's why I'm happy about the American involvement, because I think, you know, that's possibly what's going to get us over the line in terms of getting a prosecution. Maybe you're skeptical of that now, but
Look, yeah. we have to speak to people. Our job is to talk to people who know. We're not experts. We talk to experts, and just there were two people that I would regard as very knowledgeable, and they both sort of said the same thing, just unbidden, saying, well, look, you know, I'd say the strongest chance is that Sean McGovern will come back, but it might be impossible, or it might be just too far to get the Canadians back. But having said that, as soon as this pod is published, they'll obviously be extradited. But it's just, they are so, they do seem to be so comfortable and happy there.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a fair, I think that's a fair point, that they're not exactly, you know, on the run. There.
No, they're not hiding. There's a degree of confidence with them. We'll have to see what happens. But, you know, I think it was important to get our new Taoiseach on the record in relation to his feelings on it. He's quite strong about it and saying that it's remaining committed to having the Kinahans brought to justice. But in particular, I think it's that quote from Helen McEntee. In fairness, I had to push for an answer, but she answered the question that, you know, she's doing everything possible to have it happen within this government term. She's got, you know, look, hold her feet to the fire if that doesn't happen, right? But yeah, it's important to keep asking them the question, because these are the people in charge. They're the people responsible. So look, we'll see what happens.
Can we just talk briefly about their money? In 2010, there was an operation, a famous operation called Operation Shovel. It's those famous pictures of the Kinahan man and boy, father and sons, being arrested over in Marbella. O'Neill and I went over, a lot of journalists went over, because there was a first big crackdown in the Kinahans. They were put into jail, and everybody thought that was the end of the Kinahans. It was completely not. Now, the reason why I'm talking about this, at the time, it was estimated that the Kinahan cartel was worth 1 billion euros. Fast forward to April 2022, there was the same estimate that they were worth 1 billion euros. I don't think that's credible. With people like Christy Kinahan and Daniel and Christopher, who, let it be said, he really does seem to be the money man who, you know, doesn't get his fingers dirty with the crime. He organises the financial aspects of it. And we know that they have tentacles everywhere. So do you not think it's much more likely that their wealth has, far from diminished in 14 years, it has increased massively? It must have, really, because that's old, that old saying, money makes money.
Yeah, I mean, if you're able to amass that kind of wealth, what have they garnered ever since? And as we've learned, in particular about Christy Kinahan with his connections in Ethiopia, South America, clearly he is a multi-millionaire anyway, if not billionaire. But when you have that kind of money, what kind of resources have you got? As you say, are they untouchable?
Do you remember that thing when the feud started? Do you remember the cartel sent a fella with a van to Dublin to do electronic surveillance? Do you remember that? It's been completely forgotten about. And that shows the significant assets that they have. And we know that they were offering people who would have known the Hutch family, members whom they wanted to murder, they were offering them 10 or 20 grand just to tout on them, effectively. So money was no object there. And the Kinahans were paying lots of money every week to their associates, even people in prison. They were giving them a wage, effectively, and they're paying all the people who work for them in and outside of prison. So they've got huge resources. And even, you know, when you think about it, remember, there were the guards and the police said that the Kinahans controlled three resorts in Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
Holiday resorts, chalet sort of things. That must have probably doubled or tripled in value in 14 years. And even things that in the general consciousness didn't really exist in 2010. Cryptocurrency. We know that the Kinahans are heavily involved in cryptocurrency. And Bitcoin, God, it was probably 2 or 3 grand in 2010. That's, what is it? It's multi, isn't it, 80 grand or something? You know what I mean? So I have no doubt that their wealth has increased exponentially in that time.
Has it surprised you, though, that in spite of all of that, that they haven't been able to resist getting maybe slightly obsessed at times, maybe not so much now, but in previous years, as to what people thought of them? I'm talking about setting up a secret Twitter accounts, for example, and keeping an eye on things and trying to propagate, a particular narrative as to the real story behind the Kinahan-Hutch feud. With, remember, the fake documentary that was made, which was fairly high budget, with actors employed and everything. And then, as I said, that Twitter account, which was putting out propaganda. And then, you know, the famous photograph of Christy Kinahan Sr., which was on the front page of our paper. Do you think that Christy Kinahan, in spite of the incredible wealth that he has and how untouchable he may be, that he maybe had a slight obsession with his image to some degree?
I think reputation is important for everybody. And I think we know that he wants to portray himself as a businessman. So maybe he was trying to portray that, and maybe one of the things he wanted to show people was, look at this, this is the truth, this is the reality. And I also think Daniel's involvement in boxing, he wanted to become the Mr. Fix-It, or the main promoter or organizer of boxing. And I think he wanted to have that. Do you remember that, you were talking about Twitter, do you remember that whole campaign? All these people in Scotland, for some reason, were attacking all the crime journalists in Dublin. Do you remember?
I do.
Really weird. But it was clear that was part of a campaign to cleanse Daniel Kinahan, because he wanted to take over boxing, or to become the world's most important boxing organizer or promoter, or Mr. Fix-It, whatever you want to call it. So reputation is important, even to the serious criminals, let's say. Mm-hmm.
But I mean, if only they went silent, which they have now. To some extent, I mean, we keep saying it, if Daniel Kinahan had not got involved in the feud, that would be it. There would be no one going after them, full stop. So I'm saying that there seems to be maybe a slight obsession with image, even when it comes to Christy Sr., with some of the things that I'm talking about that are now being linked back to him. That he can't help but get involved in the narrative and the conversation. He is concerned, or was at least during the height of the feud, concerned about what was being said about him and his sons. And I found that extraordinary. You know, I mean, why was he arsed if he was so wealthy and so untouchable? I thought it was incredible that he got as involved as he had.
Maybe because he's so big and he realises that his reputation and his brand, if you want to call it that, is really important to him in the non crime aspects. In other words, you know, all the aircraft business, all the investments that he's in, he wants to come across as a normal businessman. And, you know, I sort of think that part of the whole strategy would have been, look, you know, we had a hard time when we were kids, but we made it good. And look at us now, we're these Dublin boys made good. And that's obviously an Achilles heel. So, you know, if you have to deal with an Achilles heel, one way is to attack it and say, well, you know, to take it on, really. So, you know, it's probably a smart strategy, but look, it obviously backfired, or it obviously failed with the sanctions. The sanctions was different gravy, you know. Yes, you were down there. Now, we obviously have to be careful because a man is before the courts, but we do, on Shattered Lives, we do think it is important to record every death. Now, a man has been charged with murder. We're very limited, but let's talk about the person who died.
Yeah, well, Shane Knott, he's a 37-year-old man. I understand he had connections to Talla, but also the Clondalkin area. He was found dead at the back garden of an address there in the Eustace de Mesny estate there in Naas on Sunday. And so the belief is that he may have been there for some time. His body was discovered. A relation of the man who is now accused of his murder spoke to Gardaí, and Gardaí called to the address and discovered the body inside. And Pádraig Delaney, then, he's a 43-year-old man, the resident of the address there. He was arrested and subsequently charged with the murder of Shane Knott. The actual charge is that he's accused of murdering Shane Knott at his home address there, the accused home address, between the 3rd and the 14th of April. So Detective Sergeant Enda Gallagher, he's the Garda that gave evidence of arrest charge and caution, and he said that after caution, the defendant claimed that it was self-defence. So that is the the allegation being made. The court also heard that a relative of the accused called to a Garda station concerned that there was a body in the Eustace de Mesne, and that's Gardaí then went and found the body. So that individual who was charged, Mr. Delaney, he was remanded into custody. And yeah, we're very much having to keep to what was said in court, because now that is something that's before the courts.
And I'll just make one point, speaking generally about murder charges, the district court does not have the power to deal with bail. So Mr. Delaney was remanded in custody because the district court can't deal with the bail issue. He can't make any application.
Yeah, at the moment. Sorry, I failed to mention that the Mr. Justice Zaidan, who was presiding over the proceedings, asked about whether a weapon may have been used in this alleged murder, and the detective sergeant said a number of exhibits had been seized, including timber and various bits and pieces. And he said that the investigation is still in its infancy, so there are still other avenues being explored. And it was also heard in evidence that the person who passed away, Mr. Knott, and the defendant were acquaintances and friends, and that Mr. Knott would have frequented the address that he was ultimately found dead at. Now, you had a great story the other week about a Carlo builder who was a stalker, and you were contacted, I believe, by the victim.
No, actually, I was contacted by someone on behalf of the victim, as often happens, and I really want to talk about this. Not necessarily about this case, but just the wider issues raised by this case. So I had been in contact with someone for quite some time. Basically, at the start of the process, when the guards began investigating this man, he's a man called Raymond Dunn, 54, and he's from Tullow, Wolseley Park. That's his address in the courts at Wolseley Park in Tullow. Now, he was convicted for one count of harassing a woman, who later spoke to me. Now, we're not allowed to name her, so she was anonymous, but she did speak to me about her feelings about the court case. So Mr. Dunn was given a 4-month suspended sentence for 2 years. And there were various other things, including that he has to pay the victim €5,000 compensation within 12 months, and he has to stay away from Tullow for 2 years. So essentially what happened was he placed a tracking device on this woman's car. Now, she had raised concerns, but there was no evidence. So she was trying to get on with her life. And one day in December 2022, she left her car in to get serviced. And she got a call from them very quickly to say, look, we lifted up the battery cover and we found this tracking device on her car. So the guards began an investigation and tracked it down to him. And the victim later told me that he was paying $16.99 a month for a sort of a subscription to that tracking thing, and she said it was been going on for several months. Now, he is appealing. He was convicted, but he is appealing, and it's going to take place later on this year. But we confronted Mr. Dunn. It was one of those things. We did 600 kilometres that day. We were trying to find him. We had various locations in, you know yourself, Paul, in three different counties. And we were very lucky in that it was just after the clocks had gone forward, so we had more light. Obviously, we had the facts, we wanted to confront them, but we also needed to photograph, because photographs are very important. So Mick O'Neill was with me in the car, and we probably had 2 or 3 minutes left, because he was getting very worried because the light was fading, and only for the clocks going forward, because I think we got him about 7:30, only for the clocks going forward, it would have been too dark to get him, but we got him, and he just said he was appealing, he didn't want to make any comment. But what I found about this was the victim spoke to us, and she spoke about how validated she had been by him having the conviction recorded against him. She said, I knew he wasn't going to get jailed, but essentially I wanted the world to know what had happened. Now, and this is what I'm coming to, people would be surprised how often victims or relatives or friends of victims contact us because they want a story done about someone who's convicted, whether it's for stalking, harassment. I'm talking generally about lots of different crimes. Very often, you often read about, you know, say in a rape case or abuse case, the victim waived her, and it's usually her anonymity, so the attacker could be named. I find it's increasingly important, the more I do this, it's increasingly important that victims have their voice, and that's a very important role that we play, that we shine a light on this bad person.
Yeah, whenever I get a story like that, it reminds me of why I'm doing this. There's lots of stories that you do that you kind of, you have to do, and then there's stories that you don't like covering, you do like covering, but every time a victim has come forward and asked for their story to be highlighted. In particular, for me, it's victims of sexual abuse. And not that that there's any, I'm not trying to rank them, but in, there is a certain satisfaction in unmasking a serial rapist or child abuser. And the satisfaction then that the victim gets from seeing their abuser being named and shamed and having their photograph in the paper. I've always been amazed how much it really means to people. And I get a degree of satisfaction out of that because I feel like I'm actually doing journalism that matters when I cover stories like that. And I've had the privilege of speaking to quite a number of victims. I can think of a case recently, two men who were abused, historical abuse, and we rooted out a photograph of the abuser and put his face out there, and it really meant a lot to both victims, just emotionally. Because I don't know if it speaks to the being believed part, you know, even after they've got justice, it kind of sometimes feels like people still won't believe me unless this guy or girl, but it's usually a guy, let's face it, is plastered all over the media, because then they feel vindicated. So it really means a lot to them. So yeah, I like that's what keeps me in this job. Those stories.
I fully agree. And you know, one of the things I always say is sunlight is the best disinfectant. And I think it is, that's really opposite for cases of sexual abuse, because, and I've thought about this, the sexual abuse by its very nature takes place in secret. And it's one man domineering a victim. And that's secret. And that man has a reputation. You know, it's the old cliche, whatever you want to talk about, the bank manager, the scoutmaster, the pillar of society. But only their victims know that man's truth, that he was abusing them. And I think that's a role. And I agree with you. I think they're really important stories that we do, because we shine a light on that person and we show the other side that only the victim knew. And other people can go, well, we now know what that man was like as well. So it is really important. And even after I did the story, and I'm sure this has happened to you, after I did the story, the victim contacted me to say that it had a great reaction to it. A lot of people had been in obviously people, you know, people worked out who she knows. Some people would know who she was. She was anonymous, but people were in contact with her and she was really grateful. And I think that's really important what we do.
And it does, it's been proven time again, encourage other people to come forward. I can think of a case where a paedophile abused his stepdaughter, and subsequent to us covering that case, another victim came forward, went to Gardaí, went through the court process and got him convicted, you know, of another second set of sexual offences, and she was encouraged by that other victim coming forward and speaking to us. So yeah, it does happen, and you know, it encourages others to come forward. So that's what it's all about.
Yeah, and have you noticed? I've certainly noticed that in the last maybe three or four years, there has been a definite increase in the number of victims who say, "I want my abuser named."
Yeah, oh, big time. I mean, if you know, I always quote Fiona Doyle, but Fiona Doyle was kind of the you know, the face of that for some time. She, an advocate for women, because she was maybe one of the more prominent cases and one of the few that would have come forward, waived her anonymity. It's happening more and more because people are inspired by the likes of her and many others since, to get out and tell their story. I don't think it's just about waiving anonymity so that the perpetrator can be named. It's also, there is a certain sense of taking that power back to them for themselves, and they're getting their voice back. And so, yeah, it's a great thing for all those women who've been abused then to stand on the pedestal, be it outside the courts or whatever means they choose to do so. It gives them that power back. And we're seeing it more and more. I think there was only a case last week, a young girl abused, I think, by her father. And she came out onto the steps of the CCJ, you know, and she'd returned from the UK after years of being afraid. And she bravely spoke out there on the steps of the CCJ. So, yeah, it means a lot to those women.
And that's, there's another really important aspect of that. If I'm right, that victim was only 19.
Yeah, she was very young, yeah.
And do you know what that shows? That there's this myth that abuse is historic. That is happening, and it is happening as we speak. there are victims out there. And I think that's one important thing from stories, because it does give people ideas and they go, well, you know, maybe I can go forward.
Exactly. And
anyway, fair play to all the victims. They're very, very brave.
Yeah, well, we leave it there. Nice.
I just want to mention two things. I just mentioned two things very, very quickly. I was at the Glenavon Mall in County Wicklow, which is the Defence Forces training area, on Tuesday. Mick O'Neill and I were down for, as I do defence as well, there was a what's called an MRE, a mission readiness exercise by the 124th Infantry Battalion, who are heading to southern Lebanon to be the UNIFIL United Nations force. And we got a story. We knew that there are 33 extra soldiers being deployed to that mission. So it's going up to 380. 375 from, take 33 away from that. And that's going to be what's called a force protection platoon. So they're to increase. Now, obviously, the soldiers there can defend themselves, but they want more of an ability and more, you know, another unit to help protection. And we had the story we broke was that elements of that 33 extra are going to be from the Army Ranger Wing. And that's very, very significant. Now, it's not the Ranger Wing being deployed, but several members of the Ranger Wing are going to be sent on that mission. And, you know, really, if it hits the fan, their military skills, their marksmanship skills, their combat medic skills, that's one of the things, their convoy skills, their close protection skills are going to be really, really important. And I think that them being there will also upskill the other soldiers who are with them, and it'll be a great learning opportunity for those soldiers. So that was significant. And secondly, and best wishes to the 124th, it's a very, very, what the Army would call kinetic. It's really, really tough there at the minute. Southern Lebanon is getting pounded in the clashes between Hezbollah and Israel. And secondly, you've got a big week ahead of you. Next week, you're going to the GRA.
Yeah, going to the Garda Conference for rank and file members. Yeah, the Garda Representative Association conference up in Westport. So that's always... Well, it's good fun, but it's a lot of work as well.
Yeah, but it is a pain of the neck, because you're always in bed by about 10:30 that night and nothing ever happens.
Oh, so of course. Yeah, yeah.
Pray for Healy's liver.
Oh, looking forward to that. So we'll talk to you next week, hopefully, if I'm alive. And, well, if not, we'll talk to you the following week. But we did say we're going to do this every week. So we aim to talk to you next Thursday. So thanks for listening.
All right. Thanks, everybody.